Good morning, friends. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Live back in the saddle edition. Happy Easter to you. It's been a while since I've been in the studio. Glad to be back here on this Tuesday, April 5th. We're out of the Easter octave, but still in the Easter season, so we can still say Happy Easter. I mean, actually, come on. We know history, and we know the transcendent reality of the resurrection, so we can say Happy Easter just about any time we want. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed, and it's my pleasure to be back with you. Thanks for indulging me, allowing me some time away to spend with my family and to enjoy a little break during their spring break week. Got to do a little fishing, a little bowling. Did awful at all of them, but still had a good time. As they say, a bad day fishing beats a good day of work any day. Hope you're doing well, and look forward to my guest next hour, Jason Hall, who's been a regular guest with me since the very earliest days when we were doing the show in the afternoons. Jason, who is the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, Catholic attorney and fiance, by the way. He's getting married here in, gosh, just about a month and a half. So we'll have Jason on. We're going to talk about Catholicism, crime, and punishment a little bit. One of the things that Jason does, working with the Catholic bishops in the state of Kentucky, that's what a Catholic conference is. It's all the dioceses and bishops in a particular state, all those Catholic leaders who have a particular priorities that they want to lobby for or advocate for in the public square and in the state capitol and among those who make those decisions. Again, it's part of the beauty of a democratic process, and we all have a right, of course, to speak our faith and to bring our faith to bear in the public square. And the Catholic bishops, who represent, of course, the entire Catholic populace of the state. Catholicism is not divorced from public life, but affirms those measures which will help contribute to the common good. It's not about forcing a religious faith. We've seen and learned from history the futility of trying to force faith, but it is some common good issues that we can all come around. And one of the issues that they've been working on with the Catholic Conference is the whole issue of how those who have committed crimes, once they have served their debt to the state, how do they integrate back in a way that recognizes their human dignity? And the whole purpose of a criminal punishment to begin with, which is rehabilitation. And we'll have Jason on to talk about that a little bit next hour. And we really draw from a rich intellectual tradition in the church, and the Catholic social teaching framework really developed under Rerum Novarum by Pope Leo XIII. So we'll talk to Jason a lot about that in the next hour. We may talk a little baseball, too. I mean, it is opening week. You know, Jason's a big baseball fan, like me, a big Cincinnati Reds fan, primed for a disappointing season. But we are 1-0. And my question of the day, I'll relate to baseball. We'll get into that in the next segment. We'll also, in the next segment, draw for our winner in the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. I'll give you more information about that in the next segment when we draw out the names. A lot of people beat Father Frank Bronner in their brackets this year, so it's a big drawing. Of course, big game last night. I got way too little sleep last night because I just could not turn off that Villanova-North Carolina game, and we'll talk about that in the next segment a little bit as well. Also want to talk about this recent intersection we had of feast and fast with the date for the Annunciation, the 25th of March, 9 months, of course, before Christmas, when the angel Gabriel appeared to Mary to let her know that she was expecting. The church's liturgical calendar, very biologically reflective, a 9-month pregnancy, right? But this year, the Annunciation fell on Good Friday, and of course, the events of our Lord's Passion liturgically trump any other celebration. And so the Annunciation was moved in terms of being celebrated to yesterday. But I read an interesting article that I'd seen someone post back on that day, on the 25th, that said, you know, there's that historically Christians have seen something worth noting, very significant, about the intersection of Annunciation and Good Friday. So we'll talk about that, and certainly take your calls anytime during the program, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BRID4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Like I said, I hope you had a great Easter and then had a great Easter octave. And I'm not sure that a lot of Catholics know that during those 8 days, beginning with Sunday, Easter Sunday, and then all through the next week until Divine Mercy Sunday, that each of those is a solemnity. A solemnity, the highest rank order of feast in the Catholic liturgical year. And therefore, you take Easter, which is the highest day of days, and then you multiply it by eight. You increase in intensity in that season. It is the high mark of the year because the whole of the Christian life pivots around the resurrected Lord. So I've said before, those who claim things like, you know, whether our Lord really physically rose from the dead or not is not really relevant to Christianity's meaning, that Christianity is an inspiring mode of thought, regardless of whether Christ was actually physically raised or not. To use a word from the old country, poppycock. It's probably the only time in 7 years in the radio I've said poppycock. Not as a snack, but as an actual word. St. Paul himself said, if Christ is not raised, we are to be pitied among all men. It is that event which is both historic and transcends history, that is the pivotal event at the very essence and the core of what the Christian faith is. This is why the Christian faith is good news, is because Christ entered into death and destroyed it and defeated it on the other side. And all the ways that death works its way out into our lives, into our relationships, the brutality of sin, how it divides and breaks us in so many ways, Christ entered into all of that, into the maw of it, into the darkest, most vicious aspect of the grave. And he triumphed on the other side. One of the things that occurred to me this past Sunday on Divine Mercy Sunday, and I have these thoughts sometimes when I'm in Mass, my apologies to my pastor, my mind sometimes drifts. It's not that he doesn't preach well, it's just I have a hyperactive mind, I think. And my mind drifted a little bit as I was reflecting on the gospel reading for this past Sunday, which really forms this beautiful bookend over this Easter octave. You've got the week before Christ's appearance immediately after his resurrection in John chapter 20. And then you have on Divine Mercy Sunday, you have Jesus' appearance both to his apostles, sans Thomas, and then you have the recording of Jesus' return to the upper room a week later, where Thomas somehow had been absent. What he was doing, we don't know. And Jesus appearing and confirming his resurrection to the apostle who had not been there and who refused to believe unless he saw living evidence. And so that gospel reading for Divine Mercy Sunday is so beautiful. But one of the things that stood out to me was Jesus standing in the midst of the disciples where they were huddled away in fear. They've done this to our Lord. What will they do with us? Jesus came and stood in their midst and said, peace be with you. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Well, of course, our priest, our pastor, Father Dan, who's an outstanding leader and homilist, he was talking about this whole issue of divine mercy. We have Divine Mercy Sunday, these great visions that St. Faustina Kowalska, the Polish saint and nun back in the 30s, had of our Lord, and how the Father, through his Son, pours out mercy on the world, and that mercy looks like something. It feels like something. This is one of the things when we talk about the corporal works of mercy, and Pope Francis has been talking about this in his dream during this year of mercy, that every diocese have some sort of visible, physical manifestation of what mercy looks like, some sort of ministry or institute devoted to simply expressing our Lord's mercy. And for the earliest apostles, for those gathered around our Lord in that upper room, mercy was not just a concept or an idea. It was manifest incarnationally in front of them in the wounded hands and side of their Lord. Mercy feels like something. In other words, we can't just talk about mercy. We have to embody it if we're going to be true disciples, true followers of the Christ. The other thing that stood out to me was that word from Jesus to them. Really, in the Hebrew, it would be shalom, peace be with you. Peace, which is not just an absence of conflict, though the apostles had known plenty of that. It was a deeper and richer reality, peace in the fullest sense. But what got me is, you know, every time we gather for Mass, just before we receive communion, we turn to each other in the Mass and we say, peace be with you. The peace of Christ be with you. And I don't know, granted, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But for whatever reason, I had forgotten or it had slipped my mind that the peace we pass in the Mass, which is not just an opportunity to shake hands and greet, the peace we pass is Christ's peace, meaning that if there's someone that we need to make peace with, someone who has wounded us or someone that we have wounded, chances are there's been a little of both on each side. The only peace that's going to overcome that brokenness that sin and death bring to us, to our relationships, to our unity, the only one, it's only through Christ's mercy, through His resurrection power over death. Christ's peace be with us. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Luther Vandross. They tried once before to go away from the late Luther Vandross's version of One Shining Moment with CBS Sports. It was ill-advised. The silky vocals of the late singer cannot be replicated, so they have to do One Shining Moment forever. That's my decree. Anyway, so big game last night. I got way too little sleep. Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show. Told myself, you know, as you know, I'm a big basketball fan. I'm a big Kentucky basketball fan. It's been tough the last couple of weekends to not have my Kentucky Wildcats still in the tournament. I know I can't be greedy and selfish. We've had been to the last two Final Fours, and I think four of the last five. So, you know what? It'll go on without us, but I had been somewhat, disheartened by the whole thing. Hadn't watched a whole lot of basketball, to be honest with you. Did not watch I didn't watch the first Final Four game in which Villanova just humiliated Oklahoma. Almost took, I'm sure, some of the Final Four joy away, losing by 44. I did watch part of the Syracuse-North Carolina game, though. It was pretty apparent early on that North Carolina was going to win. And I had that same feeling last night for a whole host of reasons. I mean, North Carolina is a very talented ball club. It seemed like, watching the early part of that game last night, that North Carolina was working much less harder to score than Villanova was. And that's typically not a good sign for your team. If the other team, in this case North Carolina, seems to be scoring with relative ease and you're having to hit high degree of difficulty shots, not going to play out well over 40 minutes. And that was the sense that I got watching that game last night. It was North Carolina just seemed to have the size and the talent inside, and they were also hot from the three-point line, it was going to be tough to overcome. Now, part of it was also my own psychological issue that I have as a sports fan in expecting the worst, with the logic being whether it's conscious or subconscious. Well, if I expect the worst and it happens, then I'm at least somewhat prepared for it. If it doesn't happen, then all the better. And, you know, as you may know, being a Kentucky fan, I typically don't have a lot of fondness toward the North Carolina Tar Heels. Now, mine goes by, and I know I need therapy for this, okay? 1977, I was 10 years old. before Ethan, who's running the board here, was even a glimmer in his daddy's eye, I was watching my Kentucky Wildcats lose in a regional final to North Carolina. I was not quite 11. Little redhead, freckled face, me, weeping as North Carolina stalled, which was a Dean Smith, the North Carolina coach, staple, the four corners offense. They stalled away the clock for a long period of time, really, and milked out a win over my Wildcats. I've been bitter ever since. So I expected the worst last night, and it was going to be my nightmare, right? Louisville, Duke, and North Carolina winning three of the last four national championships. But lo and behold, Villanova did not share that same point of view, and they came out in the second half after being down five at the half and made a nice run. It seemed to have the game in hand, actually. But much like last year, in which Wisconsin had the game in hand and let it be frittered away against Duke, Villanova seemed to me last night like they got very conservative, trying to hold on and trying to run too much clock, losing that aggressiveness that had given them a 10-point lead, and back came the Tar Heels. In fact, back came the Tar Heels, in which Marcus Page, guard for the boys in baby blue, hit one of the most remarkable game-tying threes in Final Four history, a double-clutch heave that somehow found the bottom of the net. And I thought to myself, there was 4.7 seconds left. I thought, well, here we go. Again, this is my psychological problem. We're going to overtime. North Carolina will have all the momentum, and they'll win the national championship, and I will have lost an hour's worth of sleep that I didn't need to lose. But the Villanova Wildcats didn't get the memo. And the guard for Villanova, the gutsy guard, Archie Diacono, pushed the ball up the floor, hitting Chris Jenkins, who took the shot at the buzzer for a potential Villanova championship. I'll let you hear it if you didn't happen to see it live last night. Here's the call from Jim Nance.
Diacono, 3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins.
So if you're a Tar Heel fan listening to that and it gives you great pain, sorry, not sorry, okay? Been there. We've all been there. So it's about time you were there, too. 573-4BRED4 if you want to chime in. By the way, my question today, and we'll get into this more in the next hour with my guest Jason Hall, we're kind of going through that shift now where it's baseball season, right? This is opening week of baseball season. My Cincinnati Reds, 1-0. I'll enjoy being tied for first as long as I can. Anyway, my question is, how many Major League Baseball stadiums have you been to? Whether they're currently active stadiums, whether they're defunct now, whether they've been torn down historically, whatever, how many have you been to and which one was your favorite? I'm sure Jason will have plenty to weigh in on that. But anyway, so back to 573-4BRED4 if you want to call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter on that question. But we finally come to an end now. Now that the bracket is over, of course, we have finished our bracketology with Father Bronner contest. This is where people put in a bracket. And the thing was, is if you beat Father Frank Bronner's picks, our favorite prognosticating priest, if you beat his picks, and I'll have to get him on maybe tomorrow, see if we can catch up with him. The worst bracket, like he in many ways, he was like mine, though he did better than I did. The worst bracket he has had in the history of this contest. So there were a lot of people who surpassed Father Frank Bronner's point total, and therefore those names will all go into this box. I don't know if you can hear that on the air. I'm rattling around this box full of slips of paper of all those who beat Father Frank Bronner so that I can draw one to see who can win our $100 Chick-fil-A gift basket. And just to let you know how we did it, by the way, congratulations to Cassie Greenwell, who scored the highest. But if you'll recall, that's not the deal. You don't automatically win if you score the highest, but you do get more slips of paper. It's kind of like the NBA draft lottery. You know, they get to the end of the season, and one of the things they did, because, you know, as in a lot of sports drafts, the worst team would pick first. Well, it became apparent that there were teams maybe losing on purpose to try to get the number one pick. So what the NBA devised was this system in which there was a draft lottery. And the team who had the worst record got the most balls in the lottery, drawing, but they weren't guaranteed a win. So it's the same thing. So Cassie Greenwell, congratulations, Cassie, who got the highest score. She'll get the most slips of paper on down through the 30-something other people who topped Father Frank Bronner. Now, that's removing a few names of those who were either employees here at the station or family members of employees. I mean, we got to keep that look of propriety, right? So anyway, I've got their names here in a box. Ethan is my witness. We're going to draw out a slip of paper, and we're going to see who the winner is of our $100 gift basket. Whoever has won is going to enjoy it very, very much. Hopefully, we'll have your address. If not, and you hear this, we'll get in touch with you and get it to you to see who wins. Again, this is out of the 30-something people who overcame Father Frank Bronner's picks, and we're going to draw a slip of paper out, and I've got one. And this is our winner of our Bracketology with Father Frank Bronner contest is Ben Barbary. Ben Barbary, who is, I know, he's a high school student here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from. Ben Barbary entered the contest, and he has won the Chick-fil-A gift basket. Ben overcame some odds because, let's see, he was a little bit down on the list. He ended up in eighth place, but he won. And we'll try to work out something for Cassie, since she got the overall highest score, some sort of a consolation gift, maybe some Rice-A-Roni we can send her way. So congratulations to Ben Barbary for the win in the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. Okay, we want to move on now and do some What Were You Thinking awards. It's been a while since we've do that. Therefore, we've stored up some winners. Lots of people had time, you know, with Easter and break, I guess, to do some dumb things. And so we've spanned the globe and culled together some of the best nominees for those who put acting before thinking. All right, how about this? Steak and lobster meal, an April Fool's joke. When Adams County Senior Services announced it would serve steak and lobster Friday at the Golden Friendship Center, the agency wound up fielding more calls about one menu item than it ever had before. Staff had to remind callers the lunch would take place on April Fool's Day. Instead of a steak and lobster tail, diners April 1st received three strips of beef tenderloin and lobster mac and cheese. This at the Golden Friendship Center. Really? You've got senior citizens, who some of whom are probably already a little bit confused, and you decide to play an April Fool's Day prank, promising them steak and lobster? Oh, man. There's a special place in the netherworld for that kind of thing. How about this? Another April Fool's joke. The Kildare newspaper, it's over in Ireland, the Emerald Isle, forced to apologize over controversial Paddy Jihadi April Fool's joke. Evidently, the Kildare Now News ran a story with a photoshopped image of an Irish castle with an ISIS flag upon it, claiming ISIS had targeted a local spot known as the Paddy Jihadi. Folks, there are things you joke about and things you don't. On the heels of the Belgium attack, joking about terror attacks in your country, not funny. So those are our two nominees. I'll give you the winner when we get back from the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show. Happy Easter to you. We're still in the midst of this 50-day Easter season, the glorious light of the resurrection. Next hour here on this Tuesday, April 5th, I'll have my friend Jason Hall, the executive director of the Catholic Conference of Kentucky, in, and we'll be talking about, among other things, besides the beginning of baseball season, Catholicism, crime, and punishment. So look forward to that next hour. Again, my question of the day here as we are in the opening week of baseball season after an exhilarating national championship game last night. Congratulations to the Villanova Wildcats. How many baseball stadiums, major league stadiums, have you been to in your lifetime? Whether they are currently being used, whether they're defunct, whether they now are torn down. How many have you been to? And which one is your favorite? 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Thinking about that Villanova win last night. I guess I was thinking about it. That's the first Catholic school to win a national championship in basketball since Villanova did it back in 1985. And they're the first, I think, non-public school not named Duke to win it since they themselves won it back in 1985. By the way, I was there in 1985 in Rupp Arena when Villanova upset Georgetown in one of the great NCAA finals of all time. The heavy underdog Villanova Wildcats, I think we're about a 9 or 10 seed, knocked off the Georgetown Hoyas with Patrick Ewing, the defending national champions. I happened to get invited to go through my friend Barry when I was a college student, and that night I became a big Villanova fan for that game and cheered for them in a way that last night that I hadn't since then. So congratulations to the Villanova Wildcats. Again, if you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. Congratulations to Ben Barbary, who ended up winning our drawing for our Chick-fil-A gift basket for our Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. Anyway, back to our What Were You Thinking nominees. We had a couple of them, really poorly designed April Fool's joke. Well, this one was no joke. This is our winner. This is actually from here in our local vicinity where we broadcast from here in central Kentucky. Waco Man. This is Waco, Kentucky, not Waco, Texas. Waco Man ransomed himself. Well, it's not uncommon, right? A guy gets, he lies about being kidnapped, demands a ransom from relatives. But maybe Austin Kaler should have thought about the ransom amount that he asked for. He asked for $150. Reminds me a little, what was the old joke Rodney Dangerfield used to say? He of no respect. Yeah, I remember the time I was kidnapped and they sent a piece of my finger to my father. He said he wanted more proof. If you're going to stage your own kidnapping, how about hold out for a little bit more than $150? Kaler told police the ransom had to be delivered by a certain time or he would be killed, and that he planned to use the ransom money to buy drugs, police said. Come on, we got to work self-esteem. $150 for your life? You can do better than that. 573-4BREAD-4. 573. We're always looking for your own nominees, by the way, either from your own life or other things that you discover. So would love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. Email me. Keith, who's screening our calls today, said he went to bed at halftime last night. I got you, Keith. I should have gone to bed at halftime, because I had thoroughly talked myself into the fact that Villanova was going to lose that game, and then I would have wasted all the sleep to see an ending I didn't want to see. And as Marcus Paige hit that double-clutch three to tie it, I thought, well, here, I've stayed up for nothing. And then came Chris Jenkins with the shot for the ages. So congratulations, Villanova Wildcats. We have not been following. Of course, I haven't been on the air for the last week and a half, so haven't been really watching things that closely politically, though I know there's a big primary with implications, particularly for the Republicans today in Wisconsin. It is not a winner-take-all. And according to most opinion polls that I have seen, Donald Trump looks like he could be in danger of losing Wisconsin to Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz seems to be polling out right now with a lead in Wisconsin. And there are those who think that this could be Trump's Waterloo, or at least a weakening in what seemed to be a steamrolled path for him. And that losing Wisconsin, if it does in fact play out that way today, could be very problematic for Donald Trump in securing before the convention, the number of delegates needed to guarantee his nomination. And many of the political observers who are watching the race say that if Donald Trump cannot win on the first ballot at a Republican convention, if it therefore goes, and I'll ask Jason about this because he's more of a political junkie than I am, But if he has to go past that first ballot at the convention, when all of a sudden many delegates then become free agents again, Donald Trump will have a hard time securing the nomination. And then you got to ask, it will be great political theater in which a convention will not simply be the crowning of someone who is ensured to be the nominee in just a big intra-party love fest. It'll be the way conventions used to be, where the nominee is decided. Other big news that developed, of course, before I went on our break and before we went into the Triduum and the Easter Octave, we had talked about the Supreme Court's case, the Zubik versus Burwell case, on the issue of the Little Sisters of the Poor, among others. And, there had been a lot of talk about, with Justice Antonin Scalia being out of the picture now, having passed on, may he rest in peace, that there was a possibility of a 4-4 split on the court, and that some of the language, when the case had its day in court, particularly the language of hijacking, that of the federal government hijacking insurance plans in order to provide contraceptives, and that was language that Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's oftentimes seen as a swing vote between the court's conservative and liberal wings, that use of that language perhaps tipped the hand that the Little Sisters at least didn't have to worry about an outright loss in the case. Could be a tie. So now there's been a development, evidently, that the Supreme Court has actually asked for help in deciding the case. This is from Garrett Epps, who is a recent guest who writes for The Atlantic. He said, "Not since a disembodied hand wrote many, many tekel upharsin on the wall of Belshazzar's palace." Well played, Mr. Epps, with the Book of Daniel reference there. "Has an oracle delivered a message quite so mystifying as that announced by the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday?" This from last week. "In an extraordinary order, not paralleled in at least half a century, the court has asked for briefs on a new question in the hotly contested case of Zubik versus Burwell, the Affordable Care Act Act's contraceptive coverage case that was argued only last week." So here's the gist of the questions that the court asked the parties to answer by April 12th. "What if this court tears up the entire regulatory apparatus of the ACA and just creates a brand new one?" As Epps points out, the nearest parallel for what happened Tuesday is the order for re-argument in Brown versus Board of Education, which only underscores how unusual this moment in the court's history is. See, as we've talked about, the Little Sisters of the Poor and others have taken issue even with the so-called accommodation that has been given them, in that it would require their own insurance infrastructure to be used by the federal government to supply their employees with contraceptives, both those which are abortifacient in nature, as well as those which are simply intrinsically immoral, which in the Catholic moral vision, any intentional sterilization of the sexual union corrupts and distorts the meaning of the sexual act and therefore is intrinsically immoral, can never be justified. And this whole idea of the federal government hijacking insurance infrastructures is obviously an issue that the court is taking seriously, at least some members of the court. And it comes down to, maybe Jason can help us with this a little bit in the next hour, Jason Hall, my guest. It gets into this question of whether the federal government is choosing the least restrictive means, which is a test of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That if you're going to impose on someone's religious freedom to live out their faith in its full measures in the public square, you better do it in the least restrictive means possible. So we'll keep an eye on that, but the court doing something fairly unprecedented there. All right, we got about a minute left. I just want to really quick look at a couple things in history that happened on this day over the centuries, April 5th throughout the years.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
So on this day in 456, St. Patrick returned to Ireland as a missionary bishop. Of course, St. Patrick, English-born, taken to Ireland as a slave, escaped. You would think that would be enough to scare him away from the Emerald Isle, but no, he comes back as a missionary bishop. Of course, the island would never be the same. This would also be the 100th birthday today of Gregory Peck, the great American actor, probably best known for his role in To Kill a Mockingbird. Died back in 2003. And on this day in 1951, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg sentenced to death for conspiring to commit espionage for the Soviet Union. That was 65 years ago. And on this day, sadly, 22 years ago, Kurt Cobain committed suicide. Pray for his soul. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
But I'm trying to be for maybe.
Ein Punker unterlegte in der großen Stadt. Es war in Wien, war Vienna, wo er alles tat. Er hatte schönen Berner Tal, doch ihn liebten alle Frauen. Und jede rief, na kann man Rock Me Amadeus. Er war Superstar, er war populär. Er war so exaltiert, im Kasa hatte Flair. Er war ein Virtuose, war ein Rockidol. Und alles rief, na kann man Rock Me Amadeus.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, this day 30 years ago, this song was number one. Talk about your one-hit wonders, Falco's Rock Me Amadeus. I remember that. Well, I'm not sure what the heck they're saying. Maybe I don't want to know. 5734-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in on the program. My question of the day, how many Major League Baseball stadiums here at the beginning of baseball, Major League Baseball season, how many Major League stadiums have you been to over the course of your life, and which one was your favorite? Now, that can be a defunct one, you know, one that's already been torn down. But love to hear from you on that if you've got one that is your all-time favorite. It's not just Major League Baseball season, of course, and I'll talk about this here maybe tomorrow or the next day. We'll also start hearing Jim Nance's voice, a tradition unlike any other. Big week for him. I mean, he did the Final Four yesterday. Now he'll have the Masters this weekend. Ah, the life of a sportscaster. That's why that was my dream as a kid, and getting to realize a little bit of it, at least a little bit of my sports talk here on the show, which I know some of you hate, but you're going to have to indulge. Sorry, I've got the mic. Anyway, 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in, 573-4-BREAD-4. As I said, congratulations to the Villanova Wildcats in a scintillating game last night. Both teams, I think, clearly the two best teams in the country. So, you know, it was a fitting championship game for sure. One of the things I got to do over the course of the time I took away from the station, got to spend a little bit of time, of course, with family, with my kids. As I said, got to go bowling, got to go out to eat a little bit. It was one of these staycation deals, you know. Got to do some fishing. Though, you know, when I went fishing, we went in a local creek. Really beautiful spot where we were, but it was my 10-year-old daughter. She was the one hauling in all the fish. I think of the 7 rock bass we ended up keeping and cleaning, it was my 10-year-old daughter who caught 6 out of the 7. I don't know that I've ever seen a blowout of that proportion in family fishing before, but believe me, she won't let us soon forget it by any means. But another thing that I got to do, which I rarely get to do, is I got to watch some movies and also some Netflix episodes. One of the things I got to go see that I'd been wanting to see was the movie Spotlight, this Academy Award-nominated film about the Boston Globe exposition of the Archdiocese of Boston's sex abuse scandal. Now, you may think, what a depressing premise of a film, of course, this telling the story of the Boston Globe's Spotlight team uncovering evidence of the protection, basically, of sexual abusers and predators among the priesthood and the Archdiocese of Boston, and how it showed it to be a systemic problem and really brought this whole issue into the, to use a pun in an intended way, and to bring the spotlight on this issue nationally. And of course, it's led to this long Lent for Catholics, I think, in this country and in the world, and this recognition of the sexual abuse among our clergy and the propensity of some in the hierarchy to, rather than deal straight in a way that best protects victims, to try to preserve the institution at all costs and to shuttle priests around from assignment to assignment. You would think, why would you go see a film like that, particularly during the Easter octave of all things? But I had been wanting to see the film for a couple of reasons. One is I work for a Catholic diocese. I work for the church. The chances of me becoming disillusioned are probably smaller than most, because I recognize and see the underbelly of the church on a regular basis. That the beauty, of course, of Christ founding the church upon St. Peter is that there can be little question that the church's enduring mission has little to do with our own virtue and everything to do with the power of the Holy Spirit and the grace of God. Because we have done our darndest at times to try to destroy this church which Christ founded, but it's He who builds it and He who keeps it standing. And so I have no, you know, I don't walk around with a lot of naivete. That's one of the things that I really say to people. If they start working for the church, you know, maybe they've been an on-fire layperson and they want to start working for the church's institutional leadership and machinery. I say, look, be prepared that not only are you going to, you know, see things that will trouble you, not to the level of course, what they discovered in Spotlight, just human weakness and, you know, pettiness and all those things, just, you know, the political issue. Anytime you gather people together, there's politics, just the way it plays out. But you will also find yourself, you know, being criticized, taken for granted by a laity who sometimes view the church as well as an institution that exists to provide goods and services, not as an organic mission of which they are a vital part. So I always get worried about people getting a little disillusioned if they've not worked for the church before. So I went in with eyes wide open into Spotlight. But the thing here that I thought was really good about the film, I did not find it to be an anti-Catholic film. And I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that those who call us to live up to who we are and what we say we believe, they're not against us any more than the prophets were anti-Israel or Martin Luther King Jr. was anti-American. Those who call us to be who we claim to be are not opposed to us. And also, and this, one of the sad things that struck me about the film, because I said it's a brutal film to watch, because you see these things and you recognize this knee-jerk tendency to preserve the institution at all costs, victims be damned. Unfortunately, that's sometimes what we see, not just in the Catholic Church, but we see that in other big institutions as well. It's a human tendency. Doesn't make it right. Means we have to be aware of it and work harder to overcome it. And I don't think we've completely excised that aspect within the Catholic Church. It's going to take great diligence by the grace of God. But one of the things, you know, that I liked about the movie was that the clear passion and principle of the investigative team, even though some of them were either fallen away Catholics or soon to be fallen away Catholics, so disillusioned what they found that they couldn't return. Here's what I would want to say to them, though, is look, the very reason you're so repulsed and so disillusioned by this is because you believe in something. You believe in virtues that were inculcated in you by the very church that you are now calling to account for failing to live up to it. Do not turn away. I'm reminded of what G.K. Chesterton, I think, said something like, you know, when hard times come, I'm tempted to turn away from God. But in heaven's name, to what? And the church is his bride. If he will not forsake her, how can we forsake her, even if things are ugly? So I was really struck by the fact that there was virtue present among the reporters, and it was a virtue that had probably been inculcated in them by the very Catholic faith they were now rejecting. I also was struck by the portrayal of Cardinal Law in the film, who I do not think faced the repercussions that he should have faced for his refusal to deal with the issue and for moving priests, and it appears to be with some knowledge. It does not portray the cardinal's leadership in a very good light at all under this scandal. But here's the thing that struck me, because I did a little reading after the film. Cardinal Law, when he was a young priest in Mississippi, was on the forefront of the civil rights movement. He was in many ways a civil rights hero in a time when there were some Catholics in the South who were not ready to advocate for the elimination of Jim Crow culture in the South. So people are oftentimes more complex than you will allow yourself to believe. And Cardinal Law, an interesting person. And also, as a friend of mine pointed out, he himself, as a priest, had been a journalist and now found himself on the other end of journalistic investigation. Another film I watched again over the break was the film McFarland USA. If you've not seen this Disney film with Kevin Costner, tells the true story of a migrant worker community basically in California that cobbled together a group of inexperienced runners to become a state high school cross-country dynasty among these Hispanic kids who were the kids of migrant workers. It's a powerful, I think, a very powerful film, and the kind of palate cleanser that you need after you watch Spotlight, to be honest with you. But I saw in McFarland, USA, I don't know why I didn't notice this the time before, that because you see the presence of the Catholic faith in the film, but when this team wins the state championship, this group of Hispanic runners from the California migrant community, they did it, 1987, their first state championship, one of many. On December 12th, that's right, Our Lady of Guadalupe. I don't know why I hadn't noticed that was the date, but it's emblazoned right there on the screen. Not an explicit Catholic moment, but anyone who knows the liturgical calendar, implicit. So that was pretty cool. Anyway, we'll be back with Jason Hall. This is the Mike Allen Show.